Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Thanks for listening to this Institute of Art and Ideas podcast, bringing you philosophy for our times. Here at the IAI, we're committed to taking philosophy out of dusty books and lecture halls and into the heart of public life. If you enjoy this debate and want to carry on the discussion, or watch over 1,000 more debates and talks on all the latest issues in philosophy, science, politics and arts, visit iai.tv. Remember to subscribe and review on iTunes.
The good, the bad and the controversial. We all want to do the right thing, or imagine that we want to do the right thing. But from suicide bombers to Catholic priests, we've never been able to agree quite what the right thing is. Should we give up on morality and see it as a fiction designed to justify our beliefs? Or is it still the most important tool to measure human behavior? So that's the question we are going to be grappling with, and no doubt in some form or other that we all have to grapple with in our lives. So I'm going to give each of the panel just 3 minutes to present their case on, is morality a fiction designed to justify our beliefs? With me to discuss this, Naomi Goulder, who's head of philosophy at the New College of Humanities and author of Philosophy of Action, clearly central to the questions we're going to be talking about today.
Nietzsche, Friedrich Nietzsche, 19th century philosopher, thought that our ordinary social morality of impersonal self-denial was fundamentally unhealthy, a kind of psychological sickness that wouldn't survive, crucially, a clear-sighted understanding of its own origins. So I want to agree with Nietzsche that our ordinary, or parts of our ordinary moral rhetoric, are unhealthy for us. They are deceptive in various ways, and in general that they couldn't survive that kind of clear-sighted understanding. Three features of moral rhetoric that I think are particularly pernicious, perhaps, are, first of all, its claim to absolute authority. So Nietzsche saw this as, in a way, a remnant of a belief in God, and it's a sort of pretension that the moral views that we have are in some ways absolutely right, not just our opinion or something that's relative to our culture and so on. Also, the feature of morality that it's universal, that in some sense the same answers should apply to everyone, that if there's an answer about how to live, it should be somehow applying to someone with one kind of character just as much to someone with another. And thirdly, the idea that morality is fundamentally about self-denial. Nietzsche thought that was one of the most unhealthy things about morality as it presented itself as being, and he thought that if we could really look at it clear-sightedly, we would see that we needed to change it to make it more compatible with human flourishing. And I think that's all right. And I think in particular the idea that morality is about self-denial is problematic in a culture like ours, where you get politicians, you get the media advertisers, you get economic models, all suggesting that it's fundamentally rational and natural to be self-interested, to maximize satisfaction of our own preferences. And I think that means that we're stuck in this sort of double think where we're both told that it's rational to maximize our own self-interest and simultaneously told, with this beguiling moral ought that looks like a sort of trick, oh no, but you ought to do this self-sacrificial thing. I think that's a very unhealthy tension, one that really we can only live with by sort of at shutting our eyes and closing off debate. But I want to disagree with Nietzsche about what follows. I think if we were to clear-sightedly have a debate about how we should live our lives that got rid of this magical force attached to ought and just took seriously the fact that there aren't answers that are given to us by an absolute authority, but we have to come up with them ourselves, I think, unlike Nietzsche, who thought that the higher type should act in ways that were solitary, fundamentally unsociable, and purely self-interested at the expense of others, I think that we would then have room for a much more social cooperative vision, that we might draw some ideas from Rousseau to find scope for a much more positive morality that we could accept and understand and live with clear-sightedness.
Samir Rahim, who's arts and books editor at Prospect UK, previously at The Telegraph.
There are a number of ways that we can justify morality to argue that it isn't merely a fiction, or if it is a fiction, then it's one that's an incredibly important one. The work of Jane Goodall, who worked with chimpanzees in the 1960s and 1970s, is completely fascinating because she discovered a kind of proto-morality within the relationships of chimpanzees. So if a chimpanzee had became more dominant and in somehow had control of a situation, another chimpanzee would have to do obeisance to them and would have to sort of praise them and give them a sense of power over them. In response, the more dominant chimpanzees would sometimes acquiesce and eat some ticks off their back or whatever. Now that's a relationship that comes before humanity, let alone civilization, religion, and all the rest of it. But in that, you can see that in any social relationship, there are always going to be negotiations involved with power and morality. You know, the Greeks had an idea of Aristotle had the idea of eudaimonia, an idea of a flourishing life, and that was closely linked to the idea of virtue, the idea that an individual should cultivate good behavior because that was something that would lead to the civic polity living in a greater sense of balance and, I suppose, cooperation. One thing that I think Aristotle lacked, and I think Greek society in general, it was, of course, a slave society, was that sense of compassion, or even the self-denial that Naomi was talking about, which I happen to think is quite a valuable thing contra Nietzsche. And I think that came about through religion. I think that often monotheistic religions, including Christianity and Islam, two religions that I know best, I suppose, I feel like that idea, with certainly in Christianity, sort of the ideal of the self-sacrifice, is an incredibly powerful idea. And we see that again and again. In 20th century figures, from Martin Luther King to Dietrich Bonhoeffer, to many others, we see the idea that acting in a way that is against your own interests and in the interests of others, or an ideal moral standard, Dietrich Bonhoeffer opposing the Nazis, for example, is something that still has incredible pull and power. In Islam, for example, the Quran, what is so interesting about it is that it seems like it's almost a combination of Old Testament fire and brimstone morality balanced in some ways by New Testament sympathetic, compassionate morality. So there's always this dynamic between extremely sort of fire and brimstone sense of you will be condemned to hell for doing wrong and you must have justice and you must have all this, but also there's compassion and there'd be mercy, and that sort of dialectic I think is incredibly important. Some of the most interesting people writing about morality today are people who are not necessarily philosophers. Philosophers will often come up with scenarios where we try and work out what the moral thing is to do. So, you know, well, what happens if you have 20 people who you could kill to feed one, you know, in on a track or train track, and there's a fat man there and all the other things. For me, these are really bad fictions, and the people who we should look to are people like novelists. A novelist like Jane Austen, for example, who is an incredibly powerful moralist, and the reason she's a powerful moralist is because she recognizes the limits of her own moral judgment. But maybe I'll come on to talk about that a bit later.
Brendan O'Neill is a journalist who writes regularly for the New Statesman, The Spectator and The Guardian, and he's editor of Spiked Online, which was formerly Living Marxism, which is the journal of the Revolutionary Communist Party, or was.
I was on a climate change demo a few years ago, observing it, not taking part in it, I must say. And I was really struck because one of the banners that they were holding up at the front of the demonstration said, "The science has spoken." And as a former Catholic, I was raised a Catholic, I was educated by nuns, it really brought back memories of when people would say to us, "This is the word of the Lord. God has spoken and you must obey him." And it really got me thinking of how what we've had in the West over the recent decades, I think, has been a real retreat from morality and a retreat into evidence-based judgment or into science, or as I would describe it, the exploitation of science to achieve what would once have been considered moralistic ends. And everything now that was traditionally justified in moral terms is now increasingly justified by the science. It always has the at the start, the science. You know, it's definitive, you must obey it. For example, drugs. Drugs were once frowned upon because they were immoral. It was depraved to waste your life taking drugs. Now we hear scientific arguments. They will do this, they will do that, they will damage you by this amount. The apocalypse was traditionally a very moralistic, religious idea. It's been an idea that's existed almost as long as human beings have. The world will end because of your wicked behavior. So either change your ways or prepare yourself for God's judgment. That has also been scientized, and now we have the environmental apocalypse, the weather of mass destruction. The idea that because we don't recycle enough, or because we drive to supermarkets, or because we are careless in how we live our lives, we will be punished by nature. So that's also been given a scientific spin. Even censorship. Censorship was the great moralistic, the terrible moralistic crusade of the past. This image is depraved, do not look at it. Now we have media effects, which is this pseudoscience, which says that if you watch this film, this will happen. If you read this book, this will happen. So I'm really interested in the retreat from moral judgment into the use of science to try and change people's behavior. I think that's bad for a couple of reasons. Firstly, it denigrates science. The more that science is used to achieve political ends, the more that science becomes polluted or potentially polluted. And also, I think it's bad for political moral life, because people are no longer trusted to make judgments, to make moral judgments about their lives, and instead they need all these kind of new experts and these new, the new priestly class, except now they come with a clipboard and a white coat rather than with a kind of white collar. And I would just say I'm in favor of morality, not moralism. I think what we've heard about so far is kind of moralism. It's this kind of judgmentalism. Don't do this or you will be punished. I take the more Enlightenment view of morality. Kant's view that we should use moral reasoning to impact on the world. So we should be reasoned and rational, but we should also be driven by a moral sense of what's good and what's right and what's bad and what's wrong. And I would say that it isn't morality that tells us how we should live, but rather I think morality is intimately linked with freedom. It's only by being free and having freedom of choice that we can become moral beings, that we can become morally autonomous. And I just want to end on John Stuart Mill. The point John Stuart Mill makes in On Liberty is that the more freedom we have to determine our own destinies, the more capacity we have to become morally responsible, because then you are in charge of your life. If you have someone wagging their finger at you, you're not in charge of your life, and Mill says you're no better than an ape. So I would say freedom precedes morality. It's by being free that we become moral.
And Sam Roddick, founder of the erotic boutique Coco de Mer. She's also a trustee of the Roddick Foundation and has been a campaigner for promoting the positive discussion of sex and eroticism.
I'm going to be a lot more personal about my argument, because personally I don't attach my ethics or my morals. I don't even like the word morals, because I find that's very religiously based. So to institutes at all, because I find them extraordinarily unreliable and they're forever changing according to their own agenda. So for me, I feel like the most important thing is for me to define my own philosophy and within that my own understanding of ethics and morals and what I want to govern my own life by. So for me, I have come to my own personal conclusion that I live my life by causing least harm possible. And I feel that that is on an individual level my responsibility, but also on a social level. And I want to proselytize that perspective. I feel that we're living in a closeted world where actually we are not free, and we're not free for information, that we have to dig really hard and deep to find the truth. For instance, we're all wearing, we are told that slavery no longer exists, but our clothes, I can guarantee you, 90% of the clothes, or 99% of the clothes that we're wearing in this room, is attached to slavery. That is not a consensual choice. When you went to the counter, you did not say, please may I have my top that's attached to slavery. So therefore, how can I be in the world and cause least harm possible when all the parts of the information are not revealed, they're closeted? So in my strive for a least harm possible community, I am looking for total and utter transparency. And in that transparency, I do believe and agree that we can start holding a much more kind of ethical core. If you look at the world and you see it is the richest people in the world that are causing the most pain. And if you look at the countries that hold the richest resources in the world, like the Congo, the DRC, they actually have the poorest societies. So for me, I think that we need to constantly question our governments, and we need to constantly question ourselves, and we need to constantly question religious institutes, because they're completely and utterly unreliable.
The debate. Theme one.
So I think we started off with the idea that we all, in a way, are attached to being moral, and I think all of our panelists have exhibited that facet, so in their own way they all want to be moral. The question is whether that morality is a subjective fiction or whether it is founded on some more general and objective framework that I'd want to begin our discussion with. So I'd understood you, Naomi, as saying that there is no overall objective framework, and indeed this is something we should be wary of and is dangerous. Is that right?
Yeah, and that it would be a good and healthy and, in the end, I think, ethically kind of emancipatory move to just acknowledge the fact that there isn't this authority. As Sam was saying, actually, this deference to these authorities can be itself dangerous because, you know, who knows what they'll tell us what to do. But what happens, having freed people to think for themselves, and this was also Brendan's point, after you've got the freedom to think for yourself, what happens? I think the jury's out. It's partly an empirical question, and someone like Nietzsche maybe thought that if we that at least certain types of people would be very solitary and powerful and maybe exploitative as a result of recognizing that they didn't need to be cowed by religion. Whereas you get other philosophers like David Hume, who had this much more positive view of human nature, who thought the seeds of kind of benevolence and fellow feeling were in us all. So anyway, and I think maybe that's what you're exhibiting,
so,
Sam.
Sam, are you comfortable with the idea that your description of slavery is as being immoral is a subjective notion?
No, I don't. I think that basically, at the end of the day, we do have to have a framework that we're working within. So I think that's what law has to provide, and that has to be. But we can't have that framework if things are hidden, like slavery, that it's underlining our economic kind of framework. Economics is from a philosophical point, our global economic system is there to serve itself. It's not there to serve humanity. And therefore, it is almost a inhumane, it has no framework in the sense that in Nigeria, Shell, which is an international Dutch company, can commit human rights crimes, whereas in Holland they can't, or in England they're restricted by the laws of Great Britain, but yet they're a transnational, and through having a transnational and open economic system, we're all participating in these kind of gross acts of inhumanity. And I think that's where we start to need to put in deeper frameworks in order to protect the weak and protect our environment and to protect ourselves.
Okay. Brendan, where do you stand on this? Is there an underlying authority which extends beyond our subjective view?
I don't think, well, obviously we live in a society in which there is an authority, there are laws, and you can't break them or you will be punished and so on. I think deference to authority is a bad thing, I agree. I think the thing that I find intriguing about today is that there are new forms of authority. It's no longer, you know, the angry God or the angry priest or those traditional, or, you know, the Merry White House Brigade telling us, don't watch this, don't say this, don't do that. They've kind of fallen out of favor hugely. But there are new figures who've taken their place. And I do think climate change, to a certain extent, fits into this. I was really struck by the fact that the Vatican recently put solar panels on some of its roofs and was showing off to the world. And I thought, wow, this is basically sun worship. But what's happened is that the Vatican has clearly recognized that a solar panel on its roof has far more moral clout for the world than a crucifix. You know, it's noticed that a shift has taken place in where authority comes from. I think...
But where do you stand on this underlying question, then? Are you saying that morality is a cultural phenomenon, that we all choose our own particular moralities, Vatican is choosing theirs, as it were, or are you saying there is some underlying framework that supports the claims to morality?
Well, I'm not a relativist, so I don't think all moral systems are equally valid. Some are better than others. I think there is a very basic objective moral framework that the vast majority of people adhere to. For example, thou shalt not kill. I mean, most people think that's a good idea. Thou shalt not steal, if you want to go back. People think those are pretty good.
Your religious authority figure, though, didn't they?
Right,
I disagree with that, because the largest, second largest industry in the world is the arms industry. So, and the Pentagon has predicted, like, exponential growth in conflict. So thou shalt not kill is, again, a facade. It doesn't exist within our conflict, industrial growth kind of driven globe.
I agree, but the thing is, what I'm saying is that for most ordinary people who consider themselves moral beings, they would adhere to those objective moral rules, and then then within that, I think people must be free to determine their own moral existence. Just one quick point. I think what we have today is quite a narrow morality. I often meet young people who say that they won't wear a certain thing, they won't eat a certain thing, because they don't want to partake in the kind of systems that you're describing. 50 or 60 years ago, young people would have tried to change those systems, to change the world. That was their moral political approach. Now it's much more about opting out. It's much more about keeping yourself morally clean. I'm not going to wear leather shoes. I'm not going to eat McDonald's. It's about absolving yourself of the sins of mankind. That, I think, is an extremely narrow form of morality and not helpful at all.
Well, I think morality is definitely contextual, in the sense that I find it difficult to believe that people existing 1,000 years ago were necessarily that much worse than us, even though they did things that we would now consider to be totally unacceptable and beyond the pale. Having said that, I think that you can extract general principles from the authorities, which authority figures, whether they be philosophers, religious figures, or religious texts, or indeed fictional texts as well. And I think that the two things that always seem for me to be in a balance are judgment, i.e. judgment of whether somebody's doing something wrong or unfair either to you or to someone else. That, I think, is a universal thing. Tempered then with compassion. Compassion being that person might be in a particular situation, there may be a reason why they are doing that thing. So I came back to if I may, just a small example. So Jane Austen is one of the geniuses of the world, and one of the reasons why she is a moralist and a great author is because she presents those situations so well. An example. So in Emma, her fantastic novel, Emma is rich, beautiful, young, and looking for a husband. She goes on a picnic. A Box Hill. It's a very famous scene in the novel. There's another character called Miss Bates. Now, Miss Bates is older and poorer. She is also an extremely annoying individual. Throughout the novel, she has been incredibly dull. She blathers on in this extraordinary sort of dashed style. Whenever she appears on the scene, we all know that both Austen, Emma, and the reader are laughing at her. She's a figure of fun, a satirical figure. At that picnic, though, Emma mocks her for being dull. And at that point, Mr. Knightley, who's the sort of older sort of moral force within the novel, corrects Emma and say, you should not have done that. because her situation should have gained your compassion. Her situation is that Miss Bates is a lot poorer, less powerful, she has her own reasons and for respecting Emma, and that Emma, Austin herself, and the reader get corrected by Mr. Knightley's intervention. What makes it another level is that Mr. Knightley himself is not necessarily acting from pure principles, because earlier Emma, who he loves or will come to love, has been flirting with Frank Churchill. So when he comes to make his judgment on Emma, he is also then in a way claiming her for himself. That's one example of the complexity of a moral situation. You can't ever, when you make a judgment, you always have to be aware of what your own interests might be in making that judgment, and it has to always be tempered by compassion. But that doesn't mean that the idea of judgment per se can ever be abolished.
Theme two.
So, I'd like to move on from... I think we've got some sort of clarity here. I think on one side, we have those who see morality as not being objective, and on the other side, we have those who think there is some objective framework. The question I then want to pose to the panelists is, how, in both cases then, do we arrive at what the morality is? What do we... How do we access this morality if it is objective? And if there isn't a morality, how do we determine what it is? How do we go about it? And everyone will have their own morality, presumably, if we take a subjective approach. Well, isn't it then just a way of justifying what we happen to believe anyway? Naomi?
I think in some ways the very rule-driven, absolutist moral picture that I've been saying that we should reject is a kind of natural, has a natural counterpart in the very narrow view of rational self-interest that says that basically it's always rational just to pursue your own, kind of maximize your own pleasure or something like that. And I think probably if we were really clear-sighted about things, we would reevaluate not just the moral rules, but also this kind of obsessive pursuit of narrow pleasure and so on. And I think that that means that in thinking how to live, we should not, if we get rid of those rules, we will not just be going around being preference satisfiers. We will actually have the capacity to expand and re-evaluate our preferences. So there's a nice example from the philosopher Bernard Williams arguing against a kind of very rule-governed view of morality. And he has the example of someone, I think, their wife falls out of a boat, and they're in the boat, and there's their wife flailing around in the water, and of course one thinks one needs that the man should go and save her. But William says, would it really be the right thing, the morally kind of virtuous thing for him to do, to think, oh, let me maximize the total amount of happiness in the world. Let me follow the Kantian moral imperative. Let me save my wife. No, Williams thinks, actually, that would be one thought too many. The really morally virtuous person will just want to save her and will jump in because he wants to save her. And I think that's revelatory, because that suggests you don't necessarily need these rules. They might even distort the kind of the virtue of your act if you were thinking about calculations when you jumped in.
But what makes it moral at all then? Why don't you just say, well, that's what humans do, you know, they form close relationships. If someone they know well is potentially drowning, they jump in. But why call this moral?
Well, I think it suggests a middle ground, because the perhaps what an economist, or I mean I'm slightly exaggerating, but what a very narrow view of self-interest would say is that human beings, actually, when they're not being moral according to some rules, are just going around maximizing their own pleasure. And I think what that shows is actually human beings have a capacity to get pleasure and satisfaction from doing things that are actually beneficial to other people. Now, the wife case is not expanding your moral vision very far, but I think that that gives a suggestion of how we could rethink our kind of ethical relationship to other people that would actually, instead of being an ethic of self-denial, where you have to deny your own preferences to go and get wet and save your wife, you think of actually it's an ethic of flourishing, of virtue, of having a richer sort of character, where your own interest sort of coincides with the interest of
but
others.
But I'm still unclear. Yeah. How
Maybe
do we
it's
decide,
not ethical, then.
How do we decide what that morality is? I mean, that was the question I was posing to you.
Well, I don't think there are any rules. And
if there aren't any rules, how do you...
I'm actually with Samir here that I think that probably at this point, if we don't appeal to traditional ethical rules, of course we can use them, we can imaginatively adopt the perspective of an impartial, you know, the point of view of the universe. But I think actually novels are going to be just as good a guide to this, and there just isn't an answer that's there already that we've got to arrive at.
But if there are no rules, and people hold different positions, Why do we need it at all? I mean, why not just abandon this language of morality and just say, well, this is what I just choose. I choose to jump in after my drowning wife or whatever it is. Why do I have to justify this by saying it's also moral, especially if I can give no grounds, no rules to explain that justification?
Well, just one thing. I mean, I mentioned Rousseau before. I do think that sinister as some aspects of his vision might be, his idea that actually we might somehow encounter a lawgiver, this inspiring figure who would not compel us through violence, but would rather sort of inspire us through a kind of vision of how we could cooperate together. I think that idea that you might, that while we might acknowledge that there are not absolute rules, we might nonetheless somehow hope for some figures, novels, ideas to inspire us to cooperate together. That's possible.
Let me just I'll come back to you. Brendan, I mean, there are no rules?
No, obviously there are rules, whether we like them or not, and we like some of them and we don't like others.
No, obviously, because Naomi obviously doesn't agree with you.
The government can punish us if we don't.
Yeah, morality
do this, but
is
that's
coded
not
in
morality,
law.
That's
well,
just law,
well,
right?
Well, old forms of morality are coded in law. Sometimes that's good, sometimes that's bad. But my view is that, in terms of the objectives and the subjective, my view is that imposed morality is generally a very bad thing, and also a contradiction in terms, and also it doesn't work. People react against it. You know, when I was taught it by Dominican nuns who would say to us 14-year-old boys, don't masturbate. I mean, can you imagine telling 14-year-old boys not to masturbate, like telling them not to breathe or something? And of course, you just react. You just think, why should I not do that? And then you go home and do it. So that's the kind of reaction that you have to imposed morality. It feels wrong to be told what to do at that level, but the thing is, I'm in favour of moral autonomy. So there's no contradiction, I think, between being a moral being and being an autonomous being. And this is the point Kant makes. If you read Kant's very short essay, What is Enlightenment? It's online. I suggest you all Google it if you haven't read it. It's fascinating. It's so current. It's so relevant. It could have been written today. It's basically
his answer was that reason was the way that we reached morality.
Yes, no, but it's basically an argument.
And he thought we'd all arrive at reason would lead us all to the same rule, right?
No, but if you read What is Enlightenment, it's basically an argument against the nanny state and imposed morality. He says he's sick of having books that think for him, physicians that prescribe his diet, people who tell him how to live. And he says what we need is freedom to discover, to use our reason and to become moral beings. We have a repeat of that now where we have physicians telling us what to eat, parenting gurus telling us how to raise our children. So the need for moral reasoning is as strong now as it was at any time.
I think there's a difference between using ethics and morality to control, right, which is what you're talking about, i.e. female mutilation, right, female circumcision, or that you can't masturbate, when actually, or nuns telling you you can't masturbate, that is a form of control. That is fear tactics, utilizing morals as the higher ground, right? There is also a difference from ethics and morals coming from a place of causing least harm possible. We actually do need to think about the collective in all our decisions, because we have a huge impact on other people's lives just by simple decisions we're making for ourselves. And that deserves consideration, deep consideration. And I think that the fact that there are laws based on morality in the sense of protection and causing least harm possible. So I don't think not having a framework, which is what Adam Smith, who's the founder of our economic system, fought for, and here we are in a global mess with huge despicable behaviours happening at the desire of people's own interest. Billionaires collecting huge amounts of capital and actually not sharing and causing a much more kind of poverty-stricken slave mentality world.
But sorry, can I come in there? Sorry. Okay. So For me, morality is more like language than it is a set of rules. It's something that we all share, and we all know kind of what it means when somebody says that they are trustworthy. Or we know when we say, that person, they're really honest, or that person, they're very kind. So it's a negotiation between people. We all generally share the language of understanding of morality, but when it comes down to the details, there's a level of discussion. Now, there have been two specific issues that have been brought up here, which I think show that we haven't really abandoned morality, we've just shifted the focus. So, masturbation, for example. So we had this sort of idea where the nuns told you not to masturbate. I'm sure that was a great harm to you. But wasn't there something in what they were saying, in the sense that a sort of highly pornographized masturbatory culture which we have at the moment, which is a lot about self-fulfillment and not about the interactional, interpersonal, sexual relationship with another person, is, you know, the way that that rule came up can easily be mocked, but there's something behind it. Similarly with FGM.
But the shame around masturbation, I would argue, fueled the pornification of our world. That was fundamentally, extraordinarily separating.
It's an unrealistic aspiration, but when it comes down to it, when we tell people that it is better for you to love someone and have a sexual relationship with someone with whom you love, that is an ideal which has something to be said for it. Similarly, even things that we sort of, you know, female genital mutilation. Now, it's something that I personally think is a pretty abhorrent. On the other hand, I do understand that there are certain places in sub-Saharan Africa where there are reasons why these kind of operations take place. For example, some of the women who do it to their daughters feel like they are protecting their girls from rape. Now, this is why morality has to be contextual. You can still say that this is a practice we don't believe should exist, and certainly when in the context of Britain it shouldn't exist, but when it comes down to saying things like, you know, we have to temper our judgments, our moral judgments, with the idea that that person might be in a different situation that we cannot really understand. And I think that is very, very important.
Do you want to hear more from the world's leading thinkers? If the answer to that question is yes, subscribe to iai.tv for unlimited access to thousands of debates, talks, articles, academy courses, and live events. Are you bored of the surface-level news, politics, sports, and entertainment coverage on your newsfeed? Go deeper. Get the philosophy behind the news and get the latest big ideas from the world's leading thinkers on subjects at the core of the human condition, life, the universe, and everything in between. It's free for the first month, and there's no commitment to pay, so subscribe now to understand the world beyond the surface level.
Theme 3.
I'd like to try and... that we can debate individual examples of morality, and we can trade between ourselves our own moral rectitude and say how wonderfully good we are. That's not what we're about here. We're trying to identify what it is about morality and what its relationship is and how we discover it or not discover it. So there's one proposal, which was that morality was driven by reason and that reason would arrive at an outcome which was the right one. Naomi made the case that the problem is that people applying reason come up with lots of different answers to what morality is. So what do either of you say to that? Reason doesn't enable us to arrive at a morality that we can get everyone to agree to. So where does that leave this objective morality?
Well, I think I don't think that's the point. I don't think the point of allowing people the freedom to use their reason in everyday life and to make moral choices and to be morally autonomous is about arriving at some huge objective moral framework that then everyone will follow like lemons. That's not what it's about. It's about allowing people the freedom to determine their own moral destinies and to shape their own moral lives as they see fit. This is not relativism. This is freedom. And I actually agree that, you know, we've shifted now completely. just on the masturbation question, but I will make a broader point. I'm not being specific. We have shifted from a situation where people were told, don't masturbate, you'll go blind, you'll become a lunatic, which was a bad thing to say to kids, I think, to a situation now, I agree, where we're now pro-masturbation. I was really shocked to read recently that the NHS gives out leaflets in some schools telling kids it's good to masturbate, it's good for your health. I don't think that's an improvement, and I think that suggests that it's another form of intervention, it's another form of moral intervention into people's lives.
But the question that we are trying to address is, you don't think that, somebody else thinks something differently. You know, you presumably don't think suicide bombers are doing something that's terribly moral. They really believe that they are doing something moral.
The question is whether the assertion
that your view is moral helps explain what you're up to.
No, I don't think my morality is necessarily superior to other people's, but I think the key argument I'm making is that people need to be able to discover their moral compass for themselves, because that's the only way in which you can be. Being a moral being means being responsible for the decisions you make and being in charge of your life. If you are told what to do, if things are imposed on you, then you're not in charge of your life. You're not a moral being. You are a child. You are a child in the charge of someone in authority. That's the problem. So, you know, you hear this phrase all the time, rights and responsibilities. This very Blairite phrase. You know, of course you have rights, but you also have responsibilities. This gets things completely the wrong way around, I think. It's only through being free that you can become responsible. The idea that
How free are we really?
No, we're not free at all.
We're bound by rules.
That's why we're not moral.
Well, why is that a problem? I mean, we live in societies. Our behaviour is always being bound by relationships to other people.
Of course.
It's as if we were always trying to speak our own language, and it would mean that it might be fantastic for us, but we wouldn't be able to communicate with others.
But why do you assume that freedom gives rise to anarchy? I'm talking about, of course, people restrain themselves. People sacrifice their lives to bring up children.
But they do all sorts, but they are generally free. I mean, I love also Kant's What is Enlightenment, and I think that vision of people thinking for themselves, dare to think for yourself, right? So that's really beautiful. But if you don't believe, like Hume, in a sort of common human nature, or like Kant, in a sort of common root of reason that's all going to get us in the same moral place, then it could lead to anarchy, this. And I think it's interesting then, if you really believe in this kind of ethic of self-definition and all that, what do you do? And it might be that then politics has to come in. And I actually think that the point of view of the universe, that sort of impersonal kind of standpoint, which I actually think is inappropriate and unhealthy for human beings individually to take up very often. I think it's wrong, like the man, when he saves his wife, he shouldn't be thinking from the point of view of the universe to save her. I think maybe that is the point of view you would want the government to be taking. They should think impersonally, they should legislate impersonally. So that maybe the politics-morality distinction is helpful there to reconcile.
I'd like to pose another sort of aspect to this, which is our use of morality or lack of it to a considerable degree in contemporary life damaging? Or is morality, the adoption of moral principles, itself dangerous? So do we think morality is itself a source of good? Or is it possible that morality itself is a source of danger?
Yeah, sorry. We talked about rules and advice and all the rest of it. I mean, we have friends who we go to, and we ask them advice because we think they might have wisdom about a particular experience. It might be because they've gone through something similar. That's why we talk to older people and our parents. And I think for me, these sort of vast sources of authority, which seem to be sort of being dismissed by some people in this discussion, do have a lot more to tell us through an accumulated wisdom of experience. You know, you can learn a lot from Homer, you can learn a lot from the Bible, you can learn a lot from these various philosophers as well. That doesn't mean you don't challenge them. They're not designed to be simply tell you the truth, but they're designed to say that other people have thought about these things as well. And I think it's this kind of a little bit sort of strange to think that us on our own could come to particular judgments. We talked about Kant before.
I just wanted to move on from that. I mean, there are clearly two very different positions here. So I want to move on to the question of whether morality is, or the appeal to morality, is a dangerous thing, or whether the appeal to morality is a good and positive thing.
It's like language. Language can be beautiful or language can be damaging. It depends how you wield it.
It can be very damaging. and it can be very dangerous. And I think we see that, you know, throughout history. I mean, right now, Ireland, you know, is anti-abortion, is illegal to have an abortion in Ireland. For me, that is a moral stance, like, that they're taking. So, so in that sense, I feel that causes and puts women in a situation of real danger and harm. If you look at the moral laws around prostitution, that has also put a lot of very vulnerable women in situations where they're in more danger. I think that the thing around morals and ethics is that we're in an ever-changing world, so they have to be forever shifting, and we have to keep ourselves so informed, and that's what I meant about the transparency. We have to continually educate ourselves, and I absolutely agree that from a personal position, we should constantly be challenging ourselves and opening ourselves up to understanding empathy and educating ourselves of the other side of the story to be able to come to conclusions of what would be the best way forward. So that's my, yes, morals are extraordinarily dangerous.
Are they dangerous?
Sometimes I suppose they can be in the wrong people's hands. But my morality, just going back to Samir's point, my morality is the morality of the Enlightenment, which was fundamentally about calling authority into question. You know, the motto of the Royal Society when it was founded, great scientific Enlightenment body, was on the authority of no one. This is the attitude they have. It sounds extremely radical to us now because we are surrounded by new forms of authority. The tyranny of expertise, as some people refer to it. And of course, when you criticize this expert class, when you say we don't need these people to tell us how to raise our kids, what we should eat, how thin we should be, and so on, people will accuse you, and I think maybe Samir was getting at this, of being a Philistine, of being anti-expert, anti-authority. That's not the case at all. Of course, through self-discovery, through people developing their own reason, they will read classic texts. They will talk to older people who they know. They will look back at what people have done in the past. That's a genuine enlightened approach, where you explore human history and everyday life as part of the process of becoming a moral creature. But I think the new forms of authority we have now, which have replaced the old forms of authority, I think are actually a block on the very thing Kant was talking about, which was the freedom of people to use their reason in everyday life. It's just that we now have people who seem to us very trendy, not at all like Mary Whitehouse, very concerned about the environment, very concerned about poor people's waistlines, you know, they're obsessed with obesity and so on, but just because they have that appearance of being liberal and nice, doesn't for one minute mean that they aren't repeating the sins of the former forms of authority that used to strangle people's autonomy. So I would go straight back to the Royal Society motto, on the authority of no one. When super nanny knocks on your door and tells you how to raise your children, you should slam it in her face and say, on the authority of no one. That's the Kantian approach.
But this question of whether it's dangerous, I mean, it's obviously the case that many groups of people who are fervently believing that they're doing right have done things which are terrible.
Yeah, like your
iPhone. So how do we stop this appeal to morality ending up as being the opposite of being immoral and actually causing damage?
I would say that in most cases, morality becomes immoral or wrong or bad or wicked when it stifles freedom. If you look historically, right from the fascists to ISIS, right? And I think these are very different phenomena, by the way. But things go horribly wrong when you destroy freedom. You know, when ISIS blows people up in a nightclub or kills people in a nightclub in Paris, and they issue a statement saying, we despise your free, vice-ridden, open society. They hate freedom. So all those instances, particularly in the modern period when morality has gone down that route, it's been because freedom has been curtailed. And people react against that and people get angry about that. I would always, always emphasize the freedom of the individual to govern his or her own life and to live as they want to live. That is a far more reliable way for people to become moral citizens than through instruction.
And you don't think that if people choose a morality freely that it could also still be dangerous, that they could choose to do things and think that they're doing right while at the same time killing people?
Then they are morally responsible for what they do, and they will be punished for that.
It's really striking. So Barack Obama last week went to the site of Hiroshima and did a really beautiful speech about what the what that place means. Now, every single president of the United States has said since then that they would have dropped that bomb, which I think killed 170,000 people, for a greater cause. So the idea that it's only other people who believe in mass killing in order to preserve an ideological or indeed justified, as the Second World War cause was, is not true. I think we all have violence. We do believe in thou shalt not kill, but we also believe in protecting our own societies, and the cost-benefit analysis of that is something that we can really debate. So just another point I want to make is that we have violence embedded within our own society as well, and it's not just the other who commits it.
And so just I'd like to open this out to the audience very shortly. One last question then, Naomi. If we stopped justifying our actions by morality altogether, we just gave this up, we just thought, actually, it's really just a way of saying, you know, I approve of this, and we don't need it, what impact would that have?
I think, in general, getting rid of concepts like that's right, that's wrong, morally right, morally wrong, would be beneficial. I think that they tend to shut down debate. They tend to be, you could, if I say, oh, go left at the crossroads, and then someone says, why? And I say, because that's the way to get to the station. And then they say, but I don't want to get to the station. Then we can carry on the conversation and say, where do you want to go? But if I say, don't do that because it's wrong, and they say, why? I say, no, it's just morally wrong. That shuts things down. I think it's generally bad. So I think we should get rid of right and wrong and some of these other kind of very what are known as thin moral concepts. However, I do agree with the point made that some concepts such as honest, maybe, you know, trustworthy, magnanimous, these sorts of character trait concepts are really, really important. They are the stuff of our great literature and the stuff of really nuanced conversations about how to live. So we can leave those. Yeah.
Brendan, so there's a counter-argument that these moral words are precisely a counter to your freedom. That Naomi's saying they shut things down, that the very call to this is good is a way of, as a parent might say to a child, don't do that, you know, that's bad. It's a way of shutting it down. I don't want to talk to you about this anymore. This is what you've got to do.
But yes, partly we discover what's good and bad through being instructed in childhood. I mean, we all have that memory of, you know, don't touch the stove, you'll get burnt, or don't slap your sister. Of course, you discover basic rules. But in terms of your life's moral framework, I would still say the best way to discover that is through making free choices, not being told how to behave. And I think all those character traits you describe, I think they're great character traits. And in my experience, the majority of people I've met in life share them and have them.
We might freely choose them.
Right.
But not under the guise of this, I would say, we shouldn't be choosing them under the guise of this kind of God-given or society-given or whatever rule that it's right to do
this. Of course. And the point I was making is that when it becomes a God-given or society-given rule that you should be like this, people tend to react against that, and it tends not to work. But
are we really sort of finding agreement here on the idea that we'd be better to give up on the use of morality at all?
No. I just say something? My family built a whole company that changed the way business was done. It introduced a whole different culture to business, which was socially responsible business, but they did a lot more because they got politically involved. They weren't the only company. They convened with Ben & Jerry's, Patagonia, and created a network of corporations that believed that corporations were there to serve society, fundamentally, and in their main purpose, to change things to make the world a better place, right? Now, there are very, very small philosophical thinking corporations that have effected fantastic change, and the whole premise of doing that, and they've done incredible things, was based on what was right and what was wrong, understanding that actually there had to be limits to their decisions.
Thank you for listening to this Institute of Art and Ideas podcast. If you enjoyed this debate and want to carry on the discussion, visit iai.tv. Remember to subscribe and review on iTunes.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.